It's always kind of weird playing a song right at the beginning. Yeah, no, take it down. That's fine. Because I have to sit here while you all listen to something. But I just wanted to start with that. We're going to come back to it in a little while. The reason being, we're talking about the idea of freedom. If you guys read the email this week. And so that song says some interesting things about freedom, which I want to come back to. But before we do that, I just want to say, sort of just as a preamble, that if anything I say or sounds or feels kind of insensitive to people in the world who really don't have freedom, I want you to know that I recognize that. I'm not necessarily talking today about people who are suffering real oppression. I think of people like the recent Nobel Peace Prize winner. I'm going to mess up this name. Malala. See, I messed up the first name.
Yousafzai.
Thank you, Tim. I should just stay away from pronouncing names I don't know. Anyway, I think of her. I think there's a person who really has fought for freedom and is doing amazing things in the world. Kind of what I'm thinking about today is this North American, specifically sort of Christian middle class idea of oppression that we sometimes feel we're under, which I think actually is a trivialization of the idea of freedom, and to even call ourselves oppressed sometimes I think is just offensive. And so I want to kind of explore that. So if you think that I'm trivializing anything, that's my starting point. And we'll move from there. And I kind of want to have a conversation a little bit, too. We'll see. Jay went a little long. But we'll see how things go. We don't have music today because I got double booked. Tim emailed me and said, hey, can you speak on Thanksgiving? And I said, sure. And then I looked at the schedule and I was like, oh, I'm also on music. And you know, if you come here regularly, you know that for a church this size, it's amazing that we have 5 different worship leaders, and yet I was the only one available today. So we're not going to have corporate singing. We're going to listen to some more music. We're going to watch some stuff. We're going to read some stuff, and just, yeah, kind of have a talk. And I hope you don't have an early Thanksgiving lunch, because you're not going to get there. I'm just kidding. We'll see how much you guys have to say. Okay, so when I was thinking about this topic, I was thinking back to when I was about 15 or 16. I went to a church that was much larger than this one. And one of the things that we did every year was we would get in a bus and drive to this big, giant youth conference that was called Youth Conference. YC for short. Colin remembers. And
Jason and I remember.
Yeah, and Jason. Oh, yeah. Okay, Sarah remembers. Yeah, we won't bring out those pictures. It was this thing that took place in a hockey arena in Edmonton, like the NHL hockey arena. And it was one of those things that I think was like supposed to be a rallying cry for teenagers to make Christianity look really cool and get us all really excited about it. I have a bit of a different opinion about things like that now than I did then, but at the time, that was definitely the highlight of my year. And a lot of it had to do with there were these really cool guys in faded jeans and fancy t-shirts, and they would sing these worship songs in this really hip way that was nothing like what we had at my church when we were there. And when you're a teenager, usually cool equals great, and great equals right. And so to me, that place, being in that situation, was what Christianity was supposed to be. And that meant that my average experience of church on a Sunday was just a pale reflection of that experience. And so I always kind of felt that if things were sort of bigger and louder and flashier, I would be able to experience God better because I did at these things. And then I would be a better Christian because I would have access to these sort of ecstatic experiences. And so really, it was my church's fault, you know, that I wasn't Christian. Now, one of the songs that they would sing over and over at this weekend, and I went a few years, I don't remember how many years we actually went, but was this worship song that was basically one line sung all over and over again, which is a lot of worship songs are like that. The line was, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom." And it comes from 2 Corinthians. And I didn't really understand what that meant at the time, although I really thought I did. Because like I said, these ecstatic sort of mountaintop experiences felt profound to me. They felt real. They felt great. And I thought that, yeah, the absence of these in the rest of my life was the reason, you know, that I wasn't a good person. You know, the reasons that I would fight with my brother, or that I, you know, couldn't stop thinking about that girl in my history class, or, you know, I liked to smoke cigarettes when I was a teenager. That reason, you know, I would swear too much. And the reasons that I enjoyed secular music more than Christian music was because of the lack of these giant experiences. And so, you know, I would go to these things and I would sing along with these 15,000 other teenagers. And so I felt like in these places, that was when the song talks about the Spirit of the Lord, that was where the Spirit of the Lord was, and that's where freedom was. So when the speaker or the singer or whatever would shout out freedom at the top of his or her lungs, I would join in shouting it with everyone else because that's what free people do. In that space, we were sort of insulated and therefore free from the evils of the world, evils like pop music and Hollywood movies and left-wing politics and you know, abortionists and gay people and Catholics and and science and all of its evolution. These were real things I was afraid of at 16. You know, and so we could be there in this space and be who we really were, which was mostly a homogenized group of white people celebrating this very distinct and thin form of Christianity. You know, we were free, and we sort of would walk around and say all these catchphrases, and we had this knowledge that we were free, and it was our God-given right, and woe to you if you tried to take my freedom away with pesky things like reason or facts or reminders of all the pain and suffering in the world that usually came as a direct result of what we called freedom. So clearly, that's not my definition of freedom. I don't think I was right back then. But the problem is that we come back to this idea, I keep coming back to this thought of what does it mean to be free? And I think it's important because in the Bible, freedom, the word freedom, the concept of freedom is all over the place. And it makes sense when you start to think about when the Bible was written, who was writing it, and who it was being written to. Because it was mostly written to the Hebrew people who, for large portions of their history, were actually enslaved. They weren't free. They were slaves in Egypt. They were exiles in Babylon. And even at the time when Christ came, and when most of the New Testament was written, they were an occupied people by the Roman Empire. And so they weren't sort of socially, economically, or politically, or religiously free, really. They weren't literal slaves at that time, but they were subject, yeah, to this foreign government. And so for them, this notion of freedom would have been particularly poignant. When you think about who Jesus was and who they were expecting, you know, he was the Messiah, and this idea was that the Messiah was going to free Israel from these foreign powers and restore them as an independent people. And so the rhetoric that people like Paul and the other writers of the New Testament use follows that line of thinking, that line of freedom. Although when they usually are talking about it, they're not talking about political freedom. It's more spiritual freedom, personal freedom. But anyway, for, you know, because of that, that rhetoric has followed down through the last 2,000 years. And so we have that same line of thinking. And so we have things like where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And so that's why I think it's important to kind of question that, because a lot of times when we start talking about our faith in terms of culture, in terms of the broader culture, this word comes up a lot, and this idea that we're not free because there's these other people in the world that disagree with us and will never be free as long as they are talking, basically. And the voices are getting louder. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. Again, I wanted to say, like, this is, we can have a conversation. If you guys are thinking something, speak up. Am I way off the mark? You know, what does freedom mean? if anyone has an idea, shout it out, or I'll keep moving on. But.
What's the question again?
What does it mean? What does it mean to be free? What is this idea of where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom, to you personally? Not, you don't have to give an answer when you hear something like that, when you hear the idea of your personal freedoms being attacked or in that sort of political sense, or just your personal, yeah. Again, you don't have to answer it. If somebody has something, put up your hand. I'll.
To be free of obligation and influence, to choose your own path, and to know in your heart that you've chosen right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely. Sarah?
I think for me, it came down to the fact that I'd probably never be free from my defective body, but that in that I can have peace and freedom knowing that God is in control of it and that I don't have to worry and rail against that part of me, and that amazing things can happen because of this place that I'm in that wouldn't happen otherwise.
Yeah, that's really great. I'm going to try and repeat it so that it gets on the podcast because it probably won't be able to hear you. But so you're saying basically, those of you who don't know Sarah, she's struggled with health issues all her life and come over some amazing things health-wise. But they continue to go on. And so there's this, for her, the idea there's freedom from what you can't control, right? You're saying like within your body, the sickness, the things that have happened. But there's freedom beyond that, that where you've given up the fact that you can't control that. Summarizing, all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful sentiment for sure.
And it's because I can trust God to take care of all those details.
Yeah, because trusting God and I think that's great. Okay. So, that's great. If other things come up, for sure, interrupt me. I'm fine with that. But let's go back to Mr. Springsteen there and what he was... Because there's an interesting concept of freedom. So I want to talk about different sort of concepts of freedom in especially in North America. This song comes from, this is a much younger picture of Bruce Springsteen, but it comes from an album a couple years ago called Wrecking Ball, which was basically his answer to what was going on politically in the world in terms of this period called the Great Recession that we're probably still in, I would think, and this sort of the divide between the 1% and the 99% in terms of wealth distribution. Now, of course, Springsteen is firmly established in the 1%. He's very rich. He's been made a lot of money in his life. But he takes the position of sort of the 99% to point out the injustices and the inconsistencies and the terrible things that happen when people with power take advantage of it. And so to me in this song, the key line in thinking about freedom is in the third verse, I guess the fourth paragraph in there, where he says, "Freedom, son's a dirty shirt, the sun on my face and my shovel in the dirt. Shovel in the dirt keeps the devil gone, and I woke up this morning shackled and drawn." So there's this interesting idea, I think, all through 20th century history that, in North America and in America in particular, working is freedom. Being able to pick your job and be paid, what's the proper word here? Being paid a solid amount of money for your labor, in exchange for your labor, is a form of freedom. Whereas in older times, you would have peasants and feudal lords, and people would be sort of indentured servants, and they could live on the land, but all of the work that they did went to the Lord, and he would distribute it as he saw fit. And so there was this great hope obviously America hasn't always lived up to this. Slavery is a big example. But that there's a freedom in this part of the world where you, if you work for an honest worker, you can make an honest day's pay, and you can buy the thing, and the money that you get is decided based on the work that you do. And there's some form of freedom in that concept. Now, as anyone who's ever worked a job knows, that's not necessarily the truth. And so he's sort of poking a hole in that idea. He does it in the other line too. I always love to feel sweat on my shirt. Stand back, son, and let a man work. This idea that if we can just work, we'll be okay. But at the end of each line, he wakes up in the morning, shackled and drawn. And so there's this idea, I mean, it's a very clear allusion to slavery, and this idea of people being chained up, drawn apart like this, put on boats and brought across the Atlantic, and sold. And so he's not being subtle here about what he thinks about this idea that freedom is a dirty shirt. Because there's as long as there's income inequality, there's place for people to be exploited. And for labor, which is supposed to be given in exchange for fair pay, to be used to the gain of the person with the capital, with the most money. And so in the early part of the 20th century, suddenly you had an enormous amount of people moving from farms into cities and needing work that wasn't just sustaining them, but you know, a job that they could pay the rent or buy a house or things like that. And one of the major turning points in terms of city and industry is when Henry Ford invented the assembly line and his Ford motor factory. And this idea that you could have a bunch of people doing one small job that could build a car. You didn't need a person who knew how to build a car to start manufacturing cars. You just needed somebody who could work. And so I just want to read this little bit, a description of the assembly line. This comes from a book which is not really about this, but it's called Middlesex by Jeffrey Genetes. Might be the best book you ever read if you try and read it. But it's actually completely different things. But the point, it follows a family as they immigrate from Greece. And so this is the grandfather of the narrator talking about his, or being described in his first job at the Ford Motor Company. I'll just read it quick. Historical fact, people stopped being human in 1913. That was the year Henry Ford put cars on rollers and made his workers adopt the speed of the assembly line. At first, workers rebelled. They quit in droves, unable to accustom their bodies to the new pace of the age. Since then, however, the adaptation has been passed down. We've all inherited it to some degree, so that we can plug into our joysticks and remotes to repetitive motions of 100 kinds. But in 1922, there was still a new thing to be a machine. On the factory floor, my grandfather was trained for his job in 17 minutes. Part of the new production method's genius was that its division of labor into unskilled tasks. That way, you could hire anyone and fire anyone. The foreman showed Lefty, that was his grandfather's name, how to make a bearing from the conveyor, grind it on a lathe, and replace it. Holding a stopwatch, he timed the new employee's attempts. Then, nodding once, he led Lefty to his position on the line. On the left stood a man named Weirs Bickey. On the right, a man named O'Malley. For a moment, they were three men waiting together. Then the whistle blows. Every 14 seconds, Weirs Bickey reams a bearing, and Stefanides grinds a bearing, and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. The camshaft travels away on a conveyor, curling around the factory through its cloud of metal dust and acid fogs until another worker 50 yards up reaches up and removes the camshaft, fitting it onto the engine block. And then it goes on in the description. You get the idea. Unskilled labor, doing menial tasks, easy to replace, don't have to pay them very much. Obviously in the 20th century you had this beginning of industry. By the 1930s, the whole thing had kind of collapsed. You had the Great Depression going on. And one person, we're going to go to the video on the other computer there, who sort of looked at this and examined it was a guy named Charlie Chaplin, who I'm assuming you probably have heard of. And he made this fantastic movie called Modern Times. No, the other one. Go under the star there, yeah. And then that one there. And so he's sort of looking at this factory line. This is very inspired by Henry Ford's assembly line idea. And so, yeah, let's take a look at the sort of a comedic understanding of what was going on in these factories. All right, if that was your first ever experience of Charlie Chaplin, you're welcome. You should definitely look into more. Here is this. I think what struck me the most just watching it this time is how much the people are as much machines as the machinery. I think the best part to prove that is when he's sort of going around with the oil can and they stop the machine to chase him, and all he has to do is turn on the machine again, and they have to run back and do the work. And suddenly, chasing him is far less important than getting the production going. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that at the end, it's not a police car that shows up. It's like an ambulance that's going to take him to a sanitarium, if you see the next scene. So it's not that he's doing anything criminal here. It's insane that he would rebel against this system that's so perfect and like clockwork, and how could you not want to do this job? I only showed a small part of it. If you see the parts that happened just before that, you kind of get an understanding why he goes nuts. There's a hilarious scene where they bring in a machine that's going to feed him lunch, so he never has to stop working for lunch, and it just goes crazy on it. It's great. I think it's probably on YouTube or something, but anyway, it's a fun movie. This idea that there's freedom in this work is sort of blown out of the water, because this is slavery, what they're doing, essentially. And the guy at the top there with all his controls is making a ton of money, and all he has to do is sit in a chair, you know, and say, turn up Sector 5 or do whatever. So there's this idea that in a free market, your ability to work is your freedom. But then that becomes, then it sort of hits the wall, because it can be exploited very easily by those with the money. I don't know, any thoughts on that? I mean, we all work for a living, I assume. maybe not this kind of work, but, you know, we all go to a job, yeah.
To be a bit of a cynic, though, what's the alternative?
Yeah, that is a good question.
Yes, you have, and maybe the distribution of wealth, you can put on that one, but I like the idea of having work.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah.
For some people, that's all they want.
Yeah.
Right, that the capitalist guys get all the money and everything like that, and the business I work in. but it's like, you went without the production line, for example, there's probably no way we'd have cars today.
Yeah.
And so it's what's the alternative?
No, that's a great point. There isn't an alternative, I mean, other than, yeah, I don't know. You could say give everybody money, but where does the money come from, right? You're right. There isn't an alternative. I think the point I would try and make is that not that we should all quit or not work, or that there should be some other system, but there's a myth about putting the idea that freedom exists in that work. And so there was this myth built in the 20s and 30s that you are now free to be your own man, and that there's some sort of self-actualization or whatever in that idea, in just the very idea of work. Because what happens is, when we work, when we start making money, we spend more money, we become... So, like what I was saying about this idea of indentured servants, or like the feudal system, right? These people would work on these farms, give money to the landowner, and he would make sure that they had a place to live and food to eat. And sometimes, I mean, maybe it's just my own view of it, but I think, okay, so I got a job, I bought a house, And so now I own this house, but really the bank owns it. And if I stop paying, I'm not going to live there anymore. And so there's still this idea that, yes, I'm working at a job and I chose that job, more or less, but it's still a large portion of what, I still have a lot of obligations beyond. Yeah.
Well, and also the interesting thing is I think my dad, who worked for 4 years in this company, that we're sitting on top of, and, you know, for that idea of freedom in retirement, right? You get to a certain age, you have piled enough money in your savings account, now you can, now you can be free.
Yeah.
But he's still in the store every single day that he's in town, right? Like, he chooses his own hours now.
Yeah.
Post, but he's still working. If he's in town, he's in the store.
Yeah.
Unless he travels.
Yeah.
Is he free?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he's free to choose, really, now, although he was an owner before, so he didn't have that freedom anyway.
Yeah. I mean, retirement's an interesting question, right? Like, we're all working to be free of having to work.
And for those people who retire cold turkey, the statistics on their lifespan is something like, if they go from, like, working 4 years straight, like, nothing the next day, the average lifespan would be a year.
Yeah.
And they just essentially die.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
Things about Henry Ford, though, was that he believed that everybody who worked the assembly line should be able to afford a car.
Yeah.
Which is not something that you see in many modern-day corporations.
No,
generally, they fight against people having living wages.
Yeah.
And they generally fight against the idea of raising minimum wages. Something that you mentioned made me think about a book I haven't read yet. But I read the synopsis of it, so it's called Die Broke.
Yeah.
And in the synopsis, they said that one of the emphasis of the book was going to be that probably never quit working.
Yeah.
Maybe as you get older, change your hours, you know, have more freedom. I saw that in my own father after he retired from farming. He couldn't totally do nothing. It just didn't feel right for him.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the emphasis of this book is just to see work as something that's valuable and something that continues to contribute to your life.
Yeah, I think, that's very interesting. That is a way of being able to find both together. Yeah?
And just to expand on that, work is something you're not doing when you're getting paid or not.
Yeah. You
know, that's like working as a volunteer, whether it's with your grandkids or just quietly doing something, but something that you feel is purposeful.
Yeah. So I think that's a good point, that word you use, purposeful, and you're talking about retirement and what you're talking about, John, is this idea that if you are somebody in life who can find in work enjoyment, then working can be that freedom. I think that's a good point. The unfortunate part of our system is that a lot of people don't have that. And so what you said there about Henry Ford is true. You're right. He did feel that it was good business sense for him, pay his workers enough and they'll buy the car they're building and he will make more, you know, and it goes in a circle and it's a brilliant idea. We've lost that a lot, I think, especially in the States where you're having these protests now of workers who have to work three jobs sometimes just to survive, trying to fight for a living wage. And so I want to read something this leads into about our sort of a corporation probably we've all had dealings with, I would think, that can be sort of closely related to that idea and has lost that Henry Ford principle of pay people enough, you know. It's Amazon. So I'm going to read this. It's from The New Yorker in February. And this is just talking about working conditions at Amazon's warehouses. So at Amazon.com, all of the irritation and wasted time of a shopping expedition are gone. The search for a parking space, the surly floor clerk, the sold-out items, the perversely slow person ahead of you at the checkout. You don't have to think about how much the cashier with her wrist in a splint makes per hour. The internet's invisibility shields Amazon from some of the criticisms directed at its arch-rival, Walmart. with its all-too-human superstores. Online commerce allows even conscientious consumers to forget that other people are involved. Amazon employs or subcontracts tens of thousands of warehouse workers with seasonal variation, often building its fulfillment centers, this is important, in areas with high unemployment and low wages. Accounts from inside the centers describe the work of picking, boxing, and shipping books and dog food and beard trimmers as a high-tech version of the dehumanized factory floor in Chaplin's Modern Times, which we just looked at. Pickers holding computerized handsets are perpetually timed and measured as they walk, as they fast walk up to 11 miles per shift around a million-square-foot warehouse, expected to collect orders in as little as 30 seconds. After watching footage taken by an undercover BBC reporter, a stress expert said the evidence shows increased risk of mental illness and physical illness. The company says that its warehouse jobs are similar to jobs in other industries. Last September, lawyers brought a class action lawsuit against Amazon on behalf of a warehouse worker in Pennsylvania named Neil Heimbeck for unpaid wages. Employees at the fulfillment center outside Allentown must wait in line to pass through metal detectors and submit their belongings to be searched when they leave for lunch and at the end of their shift. The process takes 10 to 20 minutes each time. Theft is a common occurrence in Amazon warehouses, no doubt a knockoff effect of the absence of bonds between the company and the ever-shifting roster of low-paid employees. None of Amazon's U.S. workers belong to unions because the customer would suffer. A company executive told The Times that Amazon considers unions to be obstacles that would impede its ability to improve customer service. In 2011, the Allentown Morning Call published an investigative series with accounts of multiple ambulances being parked outside a warehouse during a heat wave in order to ferry overcome workers to emergency rooms. Afterward, Amazon installed air conditioners, although their arrival coincided with the expansion of grocery services. The combination of ceaseless innovation and low-wage drudgery makes Amazon the epitome of a successful new economy company. It's hiring as fast as it can, nearly 30,000 employees last year, but its brand of creative destruction might be killing more jobs than it makes. Amazon, in a recent study of U.S. According to a recent study of U.S. Census data by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Washington, brick-and-mortar retailers employ 47 people for every $10 million of revenue earned. Amazon employs 14. So we have this, much like the Ford Motor Company was in the early 20th century, this sort of innovation where everyone could suddenly afford a car because they weren't specialized labor. We now live in this age of online shopping where cheap is the key word, and I can, I have to wait 2 days to get it, but it's cheaper than going to the store. And isn't that great for the customer? I mean, it's not like Amazon was the first guys to do this. I mean, Walmart, Target, places like that have been lowering their prices at the expense of their employees for years. It's an interesting sort of idea. And they would say, well, we're job creators. We created 30,000 jobs last year. One of the things that the article goes on later to talk about is the when they talk about these pickers going around, they have certain quotas that they have to meet, and these quotas go up as they meet them, to the point where it would be humanly impossible to actually meet these quotas. So at that point, they don't have to give raises to their employees, and they can even have just cause to fire them and hire lower paid employees to come in so that they never have to, their bottom line there doesn't have to go up. As we were saying, there's not necessarily that work doesn't equate freedom, but it struggles to equate freedom when the worker is being exploited by those up the top. Because the CEOs of Amazon or Walmart or wherever, they're not taking pay cuts when they have a bad quarter. You know, those aren't the people who are suffering. The people who work at Walmart who have to go to a food... in the States, a lot of Walmarts actually have their own built-in... food banks for their employees because they can't afford to shop at Walmart. So what were we talking about? Freedom? Sometimes I go off on a tangent when I talk about places like that. Okay, it's getting late. I was going to show this clip. This basically just reinforces what I was saying, so I'm not going to go into it. It's from an older movie. called The Third Man. The guy's basically the ultimate capitalist, and it's kind of chilling. I think we've dwelt on that enough.
So when do we start eating the rich?
Yeah. I'm not going to try and start a revolution. Let's figure out what Jesus has to say about this, because I think it's interesting. When we talk about freedom, I think what the problem is in this idealized version is that we're thinking about very material forms of it. So we talk about financial freedom, talk about retiring, things like that. We talk about freedom of the open road. We talk about freedom of speech, as long as we agree with that speech. Otherwise, we start talking about censorship. We talk about freedom of choice. We talk about freedom of religion, as long as there's sort of no weird costumes or headwear. We talk about freedom of movement, as long as it's not somebody we don't like moving into our neighborhood. But all of this is sort of temporal and based on personal preference and comfort. And I think that's the big failing when the North American church talks about freedom. I mean, we're coming up to Christmas. Wait till the rhetoric on the war on Christmas starts coming, right? This idea that I went to the store and she wished me happy holidays. How offensive to me. You know, we live in a Christian nation. We should say Merry Christmas, you know. And this idea that that is somehow an attack on our freedom, I think, is utterly ridiculous. I'm sure my mom and I will get into many arguments over it this Christmas, because we always do.
Are we going to have a holiday trigger?
I feel like it's a church, we can have Christmas. That's what we celebrate. But if it offends you, John, we'll call it a holiday tree. Yeah, okay, I'll do it.
As long as it's not a real tree. that affects somebody else's freedom to be able to breathe at church.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, freedom is one of those tricky things that it's hard to have yours without impeding someone else's sometimes. I was going to talk more about Amazon just now, but I won't. Buy local. That's all I'm going to say. I think all of these things, as I said, are temporal, and I think they miss this idea that we started with, that the spirit, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And so I want to read this quick bit from Jesus talking. We probably are all very familiar with this, but it comes from Matthew 6. So I tell you, do not worry about everyday life, whether you have enough food, drink, and clothes. Doesn't life consist of more than food and clothing? Look at the birds. They don't need to plant or harvest to put food in the barns, because their Heavenly Father feeds them. You are far more valuable to Him than they are. Can all your worries add a single moment to your life? Now, this is a passage that I come back to constantly, because I'm a chronic worrier about money in particular. And I think the message here, although at this point it's talking about very basic needs, but the message Jesus is saying is, you know, essentially, quit worrying, I'm on it, you know? And I think we can transfer that into this idea of freedoms, this idea of an attack on our freedoms. Really, when you think about it, how many friendships could be saved and how many needless Facebook arguments could be avoided? Sarah is in the midst of a giant Facebook argument, I noticed this week. Yeah, it keeps coming up on my feed, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to see what's going on here. Anyway, but I think how much of that could be avoided if people could actually live in peace and realize that this idea of saving the world, of fighting for your freedoms, is not actually our job. When we begin to worry about the eroding freedoms we have, we try to take control. The church talks about God being all-powerful, but it's always possible to find, you know, good Christian soldiers needing to protest, complain, or worry about gay marriage, prayer in schools, higher taxes, holiday greetings, as I talked about, theological difference, and who owns which piece of dirt in Eastern Europe or the Middle East. You know, these are not our struggles in terms of fighting. Some struggles are our struggles, which, how do I say that properly? It's not our job to worry about the fact that the Christian, the sort of evangelical Christian idea is not the dominant idea in our culture anymore. Our culture is shifting, and we're a part of that, and it's, you know, how much breath is wasted by people who don't really know what they're talking about, fighting these things. And I don't know if I said that right, but the point of it all is that when somebody asks Jesus once, what is the greatest commandment, and they're asking, of the Ten Commandments, what is the greatest one? What's the one we should follow? He pulls a left turn, and he says, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and your soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself. That is our job. That's it. Let God handle everything else. If anyone comes along to tell you that you need to care about the war on Christmas or the erosion of family values, don't sweat it. You know, so much breath is wasted arguing theological points by people who don't understand what the Bible is or who it was written to or what it's meant to be. And a lot of people are turned away from Christ's perfect great message, which is to love each other. And if these people who spent so much time talking would just think, how do I love the world around me, not how do I stop the world around me, what a different place we would be in. In 2 Peter, there's sort of a warning about that that idea. And I think about this every time I start to get a little too upset about a televangelist or a megachurch pastor or something that's saying something I don't think is correct. He says, there will be false teachers among you. They will cleverly teach their destructive heresies about God and even turn on their master who brought them. Theirs will be a swift and terrible end. Many will follow their evil teachings and shameful immorality. And because of them, Christ and his true way will be slandered. In their greed, they will make up clever lies to get a hold of your money. But God condemned them long ago, and their destruction is on the way. And I try and remind myself, whenever somebody's saying something, I think, that seems wrong. Does it line up with Christ's message to love God and to love each other? And if it doesn't, then it's not important. It's causing a lot of destruction, and I'd like those voices to not slander something that I care so much about. But I can't, you know, if I get into an argument, if I start fighting it, I'm at their same level. And so, to come back to the idea of freedom, I think that there is something in that idea of love. So, let's think about this idea of the Spirit of the Lord again. Sometimes when you hear that phrase, the Spirit of the Lord, you think of like a tangible sort of movement or a person or, you know, like a ghost or something. Not to say that God's presence isn't in the world, that's not what I'm saying, but in this instance, I want to just put aside that mystical notion of the Spirit of the Lord as an ethereal, sort of intangible element that hovers around, and think of it in the terms of, like, we talk about our spirit, somebody having a good spirit, you know, spirit week when you're at school spirit. This idea of spirit, our attitudes, perceptions, actions and behaviors. We think about the fruits of the Spirit, right? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control. Got it all. And I think that if we operated with those attitudes, we create a better world for those around us. And those around us operating in those values create a better world for us. And this, in turn, creates a freedom and an openness to speak without fear of judgment, to work without fear of injustice, and to deal without fear of being cheated. And a huge part of living in that spirit is a desire to put the happiness and the comfort and the freedom of others before our own desires. That's what's called living in community. And the only way we can learn to live in community with God and with other people around us, no matter how differently they look or think, that may be the only way we can come close to where the Spirit of the Lord is. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, that's where we'll find freedom. So I want to just close with one more song, because we're not going to sing. but we'll put the words up there. This song is by a singer named Nina Simone. If you don't know anything about Nina Simone, she's very worth investigating. Just like Chaplin. You got lots of homework this week. She was someone who actually knew real oppression. She was a black jazz singer. She came up in the South. And during the 60s, she was a major force fighting for civil rights in the United States, and she took a lot of criticism for it. I think in this song, the reason I want to close with it is, I think what's really beautiful is that the way that freedom has no sort of connection with anything human. She speaks of rivers, stars, the sun, fish, animals, insects, and those are the epitome of this freedom that she's searching for. And I can't help but think that there's a pretty profound connection between that and what Christ talked about, you know, when he talks about the lilies of the fields and this challenge to live without the worries that sort of the natural world does. So we're going to listen to that. I'll close after. Incidentally, just in case you've ever asked yourself, what does 3 minutes of absolute musical perfection sound like? You're about to hear it. And I think, too, just near the end of the song, listen to the way that she sings the word freedom. There's just so much in there, I think, from her own life. And if it's not the expression of some spirit, you know, of another realm, I don't know that it's ever been recorded. So listen to this.